Our next speaker is Stephen Smoot. He's an undergraduate student at at Brigham Young University in Ancient Near Eastern Studies and German Studies. His areas of interest are include the Divine Council in the Hebrew Bible and Latter-day Saint Scripture and ancient Hebrew cosmography. He's an editorial consultant for the Interpreter, Journal of Mormon Scripture, and has published in the Farms Review, Interpreter, and many others.
Perfect. Thank you. Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be with you this afternoon to speak about the temple. Before I begin, though, I want to acknowledge the contribution of my friend Quentin Barney, who's in the audience here today. He helped me write parts of this paper, and so I'm going to be using the plural we, not the plural majesty, but the actual plural we for Quentin and I as I speak today. The year 1842 saw the publication of Karl Richard Lepsius's pioneering contribution to Egyptology, Das Totenbuch der Ägypter. Since then, the name for this important ancient Egyptian religious text has stuck, with the customary English title for this work having long been deemed the Book of the Dead. As its name would imply, the standard Egyptological understanding of the Book of the Dead has been that it consists of magical texts that accompany illustrations called vignettes, which the ancient Egyptians placed with their dead in order to help them pass through the dangers of the underworld and attain an afterlife of bliss in the field of reeds, the Egyptian heaven. Accordingly, Egyptologists have summarized the Book of the Dead as an essential part of the funerary equipment for the ancient Egyptians, who were buried with it close at hand for use in the afterlife. While the standard explanation for the Book of the Dead is correct, it is also inadequate. Recent scholarship now demonstrates that the Book of the Dead had a Sitz im Leben as much as it had a Sitz im Tod for the ancient Egyptians. As important as the Book of the Dead undoubtedly was as a funerary document, it can no longer simply be designated a funerary text, as such a designation does not do full justice in describing the intended purpose of its ancient use. As we will argue in this paper, the Sitz im Leben for the Book of the Dead is the temple, as evidence exists indicating the use of the Book of the Dead, or at least specific sayings or spells from the Book of the Dead, in a temple or ritual context. As such, we hope to demonstrate that one might appropriately say that the Book of the Dead was used in both tomb and temple among both the living and the dead. What's more, we will not only argue that an important Sitz im Leben for the Book of the Dead was the temple, but also discuss how this understanding of the Book of the Dead has implications for the Book of Abraham. We will argue that this understanding of the Book of the Dead as a temple text lends credibility to the idea proposed by some Latter-day Saint scholars that a now-lost copy of a text translated by Joseph Smith as the Book of Abraham could have plausibly been appended or otherwise associated with a copy of the Book of Breathings found in the recovered Joseph Smith papyri. First, we want to summarize what the Book of the Dead is. The name Book of the Dead is actually misleading, because the ancient Egyptians themselves called it the Runu Peret Emheru, or Spells of Coming Forth by Day. It's also misleading because it's not actually quite a book. Criticizing the name Book of the Dead as misleading, Alan Gardner explained that the Book of the Dead is not really a book at all, but a heterogeneous assemblage of funerary spells of various dates, including also a few hymns to Ra and Osiris, selections from which were written on papyrus and deposited in the tombs of well-to-do Egyptians right down to the Roman period. The number of spells, wrongly called chapters, contained in individual copies and order in which they occur vary greatly. In other words, we have no one standard Book of the Dead, like you might have a standard Oliver Twist or a standard Moby Dick, but rather various copies that include different assemblages of spells or sayings. However, we do see standardization of the Book of the Dead starting in Dynasty 26, which has important implications that we can explore later. So, because of the connotations of the title Book of the Dead, many scholars and non-scholars alike have simply assumed that the book's context was limited to Egyptian burials and to be used strictly in the afterlife. Lepsius himself was adamant that the Book of the Dead had no ritual use, including any burial ritual use, and insisted that the contents of the Book of the Dead were strictly used for the deceased nach dem irdischen Tode, or after earthly death. As a result, Egyptologists have neglected to study the Book of the Dead in the context of its use of the living. Thankfully, however, this oversight has been corrected by the work of such scholars as John Gee and Alexandra van Leeuwen. As Gee explains in his 2004 study, one purpose of the initiation of a priest into the Egyptian temple was to see the god, which is part of the daily temple liturgy. Seeing God also plays a role in the Book of the Dead. Gee elaborates by indicating that the initiation element is most clearly seen in the vignette of the papyrus of Neferwebenef, where Nefwebeneph enters the shrine and emerges with a shaved head and dressed in linen. The connection between the Book of the Dead, specifically spell 125, and the temple liturgy is more explicit, however, as the standard initiation sequence, as illustrated in temples, for example, on the exterior of the Bark Shrine at Karnak, is washing, establishing regalia or insignia, and finally induction into the presence of the god in his shrine. Those steps also appear in Book of the Dead 125. Gee summarizes his argument, noting that the general actions described in the Book of the Dead coincide with the general actions depicted in ceremonies depicted on simple walls explicitly described as initiations. Converging with Gee on this point is Robert K. Rittner, who indicates that the concluding rubric to Book of the Dead 125 provides instructions in ritual mysticism for the living. The rubric in question reads as follows. What should be done when being present in the Hall of the Two Truths? A man should say this spell when pure and clean, dressed in clothing, shod in white sandals, painted with black eye paint, anointed with the finest myrrh oil, and having offered fresh meat, fowl, incense, bread, beer, and vegetables. Now make for yourself this image in drawing upon the pure ground with Nubian ochre, overlaid with soil on which neither pig nor goats have trod. As for the one for whom this book is done, he will flourish, and his children will flourish. He will be a confidant of the king and his entourage. There shall be given to him a cake, a jug of beer, a loaf, and a large portion of meat from upon the altar of the great god. He cannot be turned back from any portal of the west. He will be ushered in with the kings of Upper and Lower Egypt. He will be a follower of Osiris, truly effective millions of times. That this spell would be used in a ritual setting is understandable. Frequently called the Negative Confessions for its list of sins and misdeeds that the individual denies to have committed, the spell includes not only said denials, but also a proclamation of personal ritual purity, an affirmation of having accomplished righteous deeds, and an interview with various gods, where specific keywords and secret names are divulged to prove the individual's worthiness to enter into the presence of the deity. As has already been noted, it is apparent that this spell was used as an initiatory text, in which the initiate would make an oath, presumably a recitation of the negative confessions, and subsequently become inducted into the temple cult. As Rittner notes, spell 125, a text that reflects restrictions of abstinence preparatory for entrance into sacred space and time, is attested well into the Hellenistic period, when it appears in Greek translation as an initiatory recitation for priestly induction. John Gee has also summarized this work on the Book of the Dead and other funerary texts, such as the pyramid texts and the coffin texts, being used in both ritual or funerary contexts, as well as non-funerary contexts, such as temple rituals and magical amulets. As Gee explains, several chapters of the Book of the Dead are specifically said to be used by the living or are implied to be used by the living, including spells 1, 17, 18, 19, 20, 64, 70, 71, 72, 125, 128, 133, 136, 140, 148, 151, 162, 175, and 190. All told, Gee concludes, of the 192 chapters of the Book of the Dead, 55 or 29% of the texts are known to have been used by the living. Now we turn to the work of Alexandra von Leeuwen, who has augmented Gee's research. She specifically talks about the ritual use of Book of the Dead 144, 145, and 146 in the cult of Osiris in the Greco-Roman era. As with Book of the Dead 125, it is evident that these spells from the Book of the Dead played an important role in Egyptian temple liturgy. All three spells occur in the third register on the walls of the second western roof chapel in Dendera, notes von Leeuwen. This carries significance for the use of these spells in the Osirian temple liturgy, which goes as follows. Looking at the arrangement on the wall, the situation is the following. Horus arrives at the first gate, which parts him from his father Osiris. He addresses the keepers, legitimizes himself as Horus, and enters. This he does with each of the following gates until he reaches his father and joins him. Behind the two gods, the newly closed gates are shown. This has its equivalent in the human sphere, in the cult. The priest legitimizes himself by identifying with the appropriate god to be allowed to enter the realm of the gods, as is known from other rituals, and as surely must have occurred in the cult of Osiris. It is clear from Egyptian texts that admittance to the Osirian holy mounds was also severely limited. That these spells would be used in a ritual context is completely understandable. Spell 144 contains the following. O you gates, O you who keep the gates because of Osiris, O you who guard them and who report the affairs of the two lands to Osiris every day, I know you and I know your names. I have come like Horus into the holy place of the horizon of the sky. I announce Ra at the gates of the horizon. The gods are joyful at meeting me, and the costly stones of the gods are on me. As with spell 125, this spell concludes with a rubric instructing the individual to recite over these directions which are in writing and which are to be inscribed in ochre in the two companies of the Bark of Ra. Also, like the concluding rubric for spell 125, this rubric directs the participants to offer foodstuffs, poultry, and incense in addition to cakes and oil during the ritual. But perhaps what we have here as the most explicit evidence for the ritual use of this spell is this part of the rubric. To be recited and erased, item by item, after reciting these directions, 4 hours of the day having passed and taking great care as to the position of the sun in the sky. You shall recite this book without letting anyone see it. It means that the movements of a spirit will be extended in the sky, on earth, and in the realm of the dead, because it will be more beneficial to a spirit than anything which is done for him, and what is needed will be at hand this day, a matter a million times true. Spell 146 of the Book of the Dead is a spell for entering by the mysterious portals of the House of Osiris in the Field of Rushes. It likewise informs the participant of what he or she must say, wishing to gain entrance into one of the 17 portals of Osiris. It does not contain a rubric, but it would easily lend itself for adaption in ritual use. Each set of instructions in this spell specifically reveals what is to be said by N when confronting the next portal. Make way for me, for I know you, I know your name, and I know the name of the god who guards you. So once again, we see the typical ritual language being employed here. Von Lieben also discusses Book of the Dead 125 in a ritual use, and she specifically notes that at the Hathor Temple of Deir el-Medina, there is a depiction of rituals in front of the Bark of Sokar, the king offering incense, and a priest masked as Osiris beating a round framed drum. She informs us that a masked priest and not the god himself is being depicted in the image, and that this clearly is intended to show us an episode from the actual cult rather than a mythical one. Not only that, she also insists that the evidence presented above demonstrates that the relief probably does not depict the judgment of a dead person, but the legitimation of a living priest officiating in the cult of Osiris and Sokar. So what do we know about attestations of Book of the Dead chapters from temples? In her article, arguing that several temples, both in the New Kingdom as well as the Greco-Roman period, contain spells from the Book of the Dead among their decorum, Von Lieben collects and lists the following examples that we've discovered archaeologically. We have spells 110, 125, 144, 145, 146, 148, 190, 168, 178, and 182. Each of these have been attested 1 to 3 times in various Egyptian temples, with the exception of spell 148, which has been attested 11 times. 10 different temples dating from the New Kingdom to the late period have Book of the Dead inscriptions, including Medina Habu, Deir el-Medina, Abydos, Dendera, El-Karge, Deir el-Bahari, Philae, Edfu, Kom Ombo, and El-Kala. This is from Medina Habu. This is Ramses III addressing Osiris, and the text in between the two of them is chapter 110 from the Book of the Dead. And here he is again in the next room at the mortuary temple at Medina Habu, also addressing Osiris with spell 110 from the Book of the Dead. Of the above temples, the three located at Deir el-Bahari, Abydos, and Medina Habu are all considered to be the royal mortuary temple of Mentuhotep II, Ramses II, and Ramses III, respectively. At first glance, this might be problematic for our thesis. However, Von Lieben is quick to remind us that each of the three temples is considered to be separate from the tomb, and that veneration in these temples was not limited to worship of the pharaoh. She notes the existence of the cult of the royal Ka and the clearly non-funerary temple of Luxor as evidence for this. We now, by the way, this is at the wall of the National Library in Vienna. Anybody who reads German can know what it's saying here. It's talking about the ancient Egyptian Book of the Dead and specifically mentions different Textträgern or text carriers, places where we find it. And it explicitly mentions temple walls as having Book of the Dead. So this has entered sort of this mainstream understanding recently. We now go to this idea of Egyptian mortuary liturgies. Any rigid demarcation we may have between the living and the dead, or the cult of the living and the cult of the dead, seems to have been absent in ancient Egyptian religion. The ancient Egyptians themselves appear to have been less prone to delineate what was performed on behalf of the dead and what the living performed in a cultic setting. And to give you an idea of how to understand this, if a non-Latter-day Saint were to come to you and ask you, "The things you do in your temple, is that for the living or for the dead?" you would say, "Yes." And the same understanding appears to be the case with the ancient Egyptians. This is punctuated by what Jan Assmann and Catherine Eaton have called the mortuary liturgy present in ancient Egyptian religion, or mortuary liturgies which were performed in the cult of Osiris at Abydos and which have survived in the tombs of Ptolemaic priests as temple liturgies. Said another way, at the beginning of the Ptolemaic period, it became customary among the Theban clergy to take rituals and liturgies of the temple cult into the tomb. Sometimes these temple liturgies are annexed to the Book of the Dead, but usually they are written on separate scrolls. And as Catherine Eaton summarizes, the line between the cult of the dead and the cult of the gods was not always clear in ancient Egypt. Rituals often seem to have passed back and forth between the two contexts. And because of time, that's all we can really say about that. So let's go to the implications this has for the Book of Abraham. Of course, there's considerable debate about how Joseph Smith translated the Book of Abraham, and if you go to LDS.org, the Gospel Topics page, you can read the church's official essay on that. And they discuss the fact that there's controversy whether Joseph Smith translated a now lost text or whether he simply revealed the text through inspiration. We will not get into the debate here at this time, but for the purposes of this paper, we will assume that Joseph Smith possessed an actual text, a copy of the Book of Abraham on papyri. To understand what the implications are for this, the first question we must ask is to look at the papyri fragments recovered by the church in 1967 and try to understand what texts they contain. We all know, of course, that the Book of Abraham is not included in the surviving papyri fragments that the church recovered. Instead, we have in the text of the Joseph Smith papyri a copy of the Book of the Dead belonging to Chemin, part of chapter 125 of the Book of the Dead belonging to Neferirnub, and a copy of the Book of Breathings belonging to Hor. It is the Book of Breathings of Hor that we're going to pay attention to today. What is the likelihood that a copy of a text like the Book of Abraham could have been appended to a text like the Book of Breathings? Said another way, is it possible that an ancient Egyptian living in Ptolemaic Egypt would have had any interest at all in including such a text in his personal collection? To answer this question, we must familiarize ourselves with the ancient owners of the Joseph Smith papyri and their occupations. We will focus on Hor. We know that Hor was a member of a priestly family living in Thebes and was, among his other important cultic functions, involved in the daily temple liturgy at Karnak. Besides owning a copy of the Book of Breathings, Hor also owned an abbreviated copy of the Book of the Dead that now resides in the Louvre. As a priest in Ptolemaic Egypt, Hor would have enjoyed a relatively cosmopolitan lifestyle and very likely would have been highly educated, literate, and likely conversant in several languages. He also would have had access to the great libraries of the temples in Thebes, and this deserves special attention. As Carrie Muhlstein has shown, Egyptians during this time engaged in a well-attested syncretism of their religion with biblical figures. In Ptolemaic and Roman Egypt, Muhlstein explains, biblical stories and characters were employed in Egyptian religious practice. These stories and characters were added to the already existing repertoire of Egyptian, Canaanite, and Greek gods and mythical characters. These biblical figures were used in a manner similar to Egyptian figures, and two of the characters who loom largest in the Jewish canon, Abraham and Moses, were used in contexts that were in keeping with their biblical stories. How is this significant? Our current evidence indicates that a group of priests from Thebes possessed, read, understood, and employed biblical and extra-biblical texts, most especially texts about Abraham and Moses. As Hugh Nibley was one of the first to note, the most important thing about the Book of Breathings from Latter-day Saint point of view is that it was far more than a funeral text. If the mortuary use of at least some of the important texts, like the Book of the Dead and the Book of Breathings, is secondary, Nibley asked, what was their original primary function? The answer, they were temple texts used in the performance of ordinances. And if you want to, you can read Nibley's book, The Message of the Joseph Smith Papyri, where he elaborates on this. But for our time today, we have to skip that, unfortunately. Given von Leeuwen's discussion of the ritual use of the spells of the Book of the Dead, this may have significance for the Book of Breathings as a ritual text. Like the Book of Breathings, the Book of Abraham, too, has an undeniable association with the temple. Besides having served as an inspirational element in Joseph Smith's Nauvoo Temple liturgy, the Book of Abraham's narrative and the cosmology fit nicely in both ancient and in both an ancient and modern temple context. With this understanding, we can now critically engage a comment made by the Egyptologist Mark Kunin in his recent treatment of the Book of Breathings. No one denies that other funeral and or ritual compositions were sometimes appended to the Book of the Dead or other funerary compositions, Kunin remarks. However, concluding that a record of Abraham or any text foreign to Ptolemaic Egyptian funerary and or liturgical practice was once attached to the Smith papyri is an assertion not based on widely accepted Egyptological analysis. In light of the evidence examined above, we feel Kunin's conclusion requires qualification. Given that our Theban priest Hor had a professional interest in not only the temple but also human sacrifice, and you can read the research from John Gee on that last point if you're interested in that, and given what we have reviewed about the temple context of the Book of the Dead and its Greco-Roman descendant, the Book of Breathings, a copy of both of which Hor possessed, we do not find it too much of a stretch to suppose that a temple text like the Book of Abraham could have attracted Hor's fancy and thus ended up in his possession, perhaps snuggled right alongside his copy of the Book of Breathings. Recalling Asman's point noted earlier, that Theban priests in Ptolemaic Egypt are known to have taken temple liturgies with them into their tombs, we feel it is by no means impossible that a copy of the Book of Abraham could have been buried with Hor either as an appendix on his Book of Breathings or as a separate scroll. Add to this the fact that some Theban priests were actively syncretizing biblical figures with their native mythological figures, including syncretizing Osiris with Abraham, and we feel a plausible case can be made for why and how a copy of the Book of Abraham could have ended up among the Joseph Smith papyri. We obviously cannot prove this happened, as any hypothetical Abraham text among the Joseph Smith papyri is now lost, but the evidence examined above suggests that this scenario is by no means implausible or impossible. So our conclusion, the Book of the Dead is often simply classified as a funerary text, but it had at least one actual Zitzim Leben, the temple. The above discussion suggests two different Zitzim Leben for Book of the Dead texts in the temple. Some spells are closely associated with the solar cult, while others are concerned with gaining admission into restricted areas, mostly in connection with Osiris. Both groups stem from a priestly milieu. There was nothing funerary about them originally. With this evidence in mind, we feel it is important to reiterate a point made by John Gee a decade ago. Egyptian religion has been divided into a number of modern subcategories: funerary religion, temple religion, magic, and popular piety. So-called magical texts and practices have been shown to have been composed in temple scriptoria and used by priests. In fact, there is no ancient distinction between magic and Egyptian religion. Furthermore, all funerary equipment, with the exception of coffins and canopic jars, have been found in both temple and magic contexts. All of these considerations raise the issue of whether the modern distinctions between temple, funerary, and magic religion are useful or even desirable, as they may constitute an impediment rather than an aid to understanding. As such, we must urge caution in simply identifying the Book of the Dead as a funerary text, as this term, while true in a limited sense, does not do full justice in describing how this important religious text was utilized by the ancient Egyptians. Also, with this evidence in mind, we can plausibly suggest a scenario for how a text like the Book of Abraham could have ended up in a collection of funerary Egyptian papyri that were eventually acquired by Joseph Smith. If in fact the Book of the Dead and its descendant, the Book of Breathings, were used as temple texts, as we feel the evidence indicates, then it would make sense that a copy of another temple text, like the Book of Abraham, could have been acquired by Hor, a Theban priest who likely would have found interest in just such a text. With the evidence presented by Muhlstein on the Egyptian syncretism of Jewish religious figures, including Moses and Abraham, during the time and production of the Hor Book of Breathings, we feel this scenario is at least plausible. Thus, in addition to this research on the Book of the Dead as a temple text being interesting in its own right, this evidence also potentially carries significant implications for the Book of Abraham. Thank you.
We have 5 minutes for questions.
Oh, now the fun begins. So you'll get him on my feet.
What are the facsimiles from, and how do they relate to your thesis here?
So facsimiles 1 and 3 come from the same roll, from the Hoare Book of Breathings. Facsimile 1, the original, has survived. It's now housed up in the Church History Archives. And there's been a lot of work done on it. There's a lot of controversy surrounding it, of course. Facsimile 3, unfortunately, has not survived. It is presumably lost with the rest of Joseph Smith's papyri. Facsimile 2 is unrelated to facsimiles 1 and 3. It is a what's commonly called a hypocephalus, and appears to have belonged to a man by the name of Sheshonq, and doesn't have connection with Hoare's Book of Breathings that we have. How this relates to my thesis, if I had time, I could fully flesh it out. But there's an interesting article by Kevin Barney talking about the fact that Jews and Egyptians are syncretizing their iconography with each other. And so we have, and this is going on with Muhlstein, we have Jewish figures being represented in Egyptian contexts and vice versa, whereas they're taking the original meaning and reapplying it or giving it new interpretation or understanding to fit a new context. And Kevin Barney has discussed this extensively. We can't get into here today. But how this would go into my thesis, I would say, is that, again, as one possibility, we have this Theban priest Hoare, who's engaged in this syncretism, drawing on biblical figures and incorporating it into his Book of Breathings, or possibly vice versa, which is what Kevin Barney hypothesizes, that we have a hypothetical redactor, he calls him J-Red for Jewish redactor, taking Egyptian iconography and giving it a Jewish or Semitic understanding or interpretation, which we know is actually going on at the same time. It's going in both directions. So the short of it is, I think there's some syncretism going on here with the facsimiles, whether this is an ancient redactor or an ancient priest that's doing this, or whether Joseph Smith is inspired in his revelation to sort of adapt it in this new context is open to discussion. But I think that's sort of ways we can approach it and try to understand what's happening with the facsimiles.
You speculated all of the scroll of Joseph had to do with Joseph's understanding of the temple.
Oh, that's a good question. And my friend Quentin actually is going to be publishing a paper soon on the Book of Joseph and the writings of Joseph in the Joseph Smith Papyri. We don't know much about the Book of Joseph, unfortunately. We have some statements by people who, you know, were involved in the production who talk about some of its contents and, you know, what it involved, but we don't have any published text, and so it's hard to say precisely how it may have been involved in the temple. So I'm cautious about going too far there just because we don't really know what was fully entailed, but it would not surprise me if, in fact, it did involve the temple in some way and inspire Joseph Smith in the same way that the Book of Abraham inspires Joseph Smith in the Nauvoo Temple.
Would your thesis help critics of the Book of Abraham and its origin a little bit? Do you think that would quell any of them or help us maybe gain a little bit more respect for the Book of Abraham, even amongst members of the church who are on the edge?
Well, you know, that's a good question, and not wanting to read anybody's minds, I don't know if my thesis will be influential or not with these individuals. But what I hope to show here, at least, is the common sort of refrain we've been hearing. This papyri is a bunch of pagan funerary nonsense that has nothing to do with Abraham, and, you know, it's absurd to associate with Abraham. I think that's called into question. At least I believe now we have a scenario where a text like the Book of Abraham could have been associated with these texts, given that they both have connections with the temple. So maybe it might help in that way. At least I also hope that people will consider more this possibility as opposed to just dismissing it out of hand, that a copy of the Book of Abraham could have been in among the Joseph Smith papyri that we have recovered. Anything else? I'm out of time. One more maybe, if anyone? Okay, great. Thank you very much.